Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to witness some scenes from the next attraction to play this theater. This picture, truly one of the most unusual ever filmed, contains scenes which under no circumstances should be viewed by anyone with a heart condition or anyone who is easily upset. We urgently recommend that if you are such a person or the parent of a young or impressionable child now in attendance, that you and the child leave the auditorium for the next 90 seconds.
Good evening, and welcome to another episode of the Video Nasty Project. Tonight, we're going to be watching a movie that you've probably never heard of, a little independent horror movie called Friday the 13th. What the fuck is that? No, Pamela is the killer in the first one, not Jason. And he doesn't get the hockey mask until part three. That's not even on the fucking list. And that's Roy. He's from part five. That's not even Jason. Would you get the fuck out of here? Ah, goddamn. Roll the trailer. I'm surrounded by idiots.
Hello? Who's that? Oh, hi. What are you doing out in this mess?
One. Two.
You're doomed. You're all doomed.
Three.
We weren't doing anything. We were just messing around.
Four. Five.
Dave! Oh, Dave!
Six.
It must be my imagination.
Seven.
Can I help you? Hello?
Eight. Nine. Ten. Eleven. Twelve. Friday the 13th. You may only see it once, but that will be enough. Friday the 13th.
And we just got done watching again for the 150th time, watching Friday the 13th Part 1 from 1980. A little independent horror movie that you've probably never heard of.
It wasn't independent, though.
It was independent.
It was 100%
Sean Cunningham did it all himself.
Yeah, it was a budget of around $550,000. And after he got it done, he started shopping around. And the two big contenders... Warner Brothers and Paramount. Paramount got United States distribution and Warner got international.
Huh.
And the film made like $50 million.
Off of a $350,000 return. That's not a bad investment.
And unfortunately, none of the other films ever showed that kind of turnaround.
Because they upped the budgets after that.
Here, a quick synopsis, shall we?
Two counselors having sex in the 1950s at a camp, and the boy drowns in a lake.
And then Mama comes back, and she murders a whole bunch of camp counselors in 1980, and then Jason jumps out of a lake. The end.
But she killed camp counselors in 1950s.
Yes, she did, when she was a young woman.
Anyway.
And then she killed more camp counselors, like, 20 years later as a middle-aged woman. She was a very robust middle-aged woman. She could yeet people through windows. She was impressive.
I want to get right into the cold opening. I really like the cold opening. The bit in 1950 where the counselors are sitting around the fireplace and they're singing Kumbaya, and then a couple of them go off and they fuck, and then Pamela comes along and kills them. Really sets the mood. I really liked that cold opening.
The cold open worked because it let the movie start off with a kill. Mm-hmm. Let, you know, basically, you know, we're not going to tease you because there's not going to be a kill again for a little while because we need to establish stuff. So let's give you a appetizer kill. And then go from there and kind of also set the yellow. I never pronounce it the same way twice. The yellow tone. Again, a little Bay of Bloodish, because that movie also starts with a couple of murders. Setting the tone, and then we got a while before someone dies.
And I think that the setting the tone and the cold opening really shows off. I think Sean Cunningham is an underrated director. He really does some very nice stuff in this movie.
Yeah, one of the oddities of this movie to me was our final girl isn't even in the mode of being a final girl until she
quite literally is.
Yeah.
And that's one of the weaknesses with the ending is that, okay, let's address the elephant in the room. The fact that we can't know the whodunit because Pamela Voorhees does not show up as a character anywhere in this entire movie until the last 15 minutes. And then she shows up and it's like, oh, hi, come here, honey. And then by that point in the movie, it's either you're going to be the killer or something's going on.
Or you're going to die real quick.
Yeah.
Oh, hi, nice old lady. We've never met. Oh, you're dead. Or, hi, nice old lady. Why are you holding that knife? And it's, why are you holding that knife? It's one of the weaknesses of the film that they try and build up this mystery of who's killing. And it's the, you know, in a murder mystery, when you introduce a new character, they show up for one scene and you never see him throughout the rest of the movie.
He instantly pegs you as the killer.
Or you show up out of the blue towards the end of the film, you're probably the killer. It's the one thing that keeps it from being a nice murder mystery. Up till then, the faceless killer is just part of the tension.
And that's a damn shame because Betsy Palmer, hands down, is the MVP in this movie. She is far and away has gravitas and this great acting ability. That whole, when she's doing the Jason voice, and she's channeling Jason. It's like, kill her, mommy, kill her, is really chilling. I would have liked to have seen her throughout the entire movie as an actual character.
Yeah. Her main career was back in the early days of American television when everything that was going on was a theater by a sponsor.
Or she did a lot of time on some game shows in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah. So she did. She went all the way through up until this point. I think one of her first really significant major motion picture is Mr. Roberts. She's one of the lieutenants, one of the women lieutenants in that film. And if Tony is Mr. Roberts is a World War II film.
Yeah, I know
it. It involves a nondescript boat that really isn't involved in the war at all. But it's a good comedy, and if you haven't seen it, go see it. But that's her real, real solid first Hollywood movie. And then after that, she's back in television. She did this and then went right back to television again. She was in Love Boat, Chips, and on, all through the 80s.
And, okay, I'm going to objectify a lady here. Please forgive me. Betsy Palmer, when she was younger back in the 50s, was really fucking hot. Ridiculously hot.
Well, yeah. She was often a love interest. I mean, that's you know, but she was also from an era where, I mean, that was kind of her job. And I think one of the nice things about Friday the 13th is, A, it, you know, utilized her acting talent. Also, it brought her to a new generation of fans. She was completely surprised how many women sympathized with Pamela. And that she would have people come up to her at conventions wanting her to hold their kids and have pictures taken because they empathized with the maternal aspect of the character.
And she had always come into this thinking, okay, this is going to be a cheap horror movie. I'm going to get paid and I'm going to never hear of it ever again.
She needed a new car. Literally, I've read the text. She needed a new car. And the what she would get paid for her 15 minutes of screen time would cover the cost of the new car she wanted to buy. And she figured it was a fair trade-off. And little did she know she was going to become a film icon. Which it's odd that of all the things she's known for, this is the thing she's most remembered for.
So there was the book Men, Women, and Chainsaws. Carol J. I can't remember her exact name. But anyway, the gal writing that book, she mentions that in Friday the 13th, the first film, the gender rug is pulled out from underneath because this is the first time in American movies a woman is the crazed killer. You had seen a little bit of it in, like, Italian horror movies. You know, your giallos and stuff have women killers occasionally. But yeah, for the mainstream American movies, this is probably the first time that I can think of that had somebody like that.
Yeah, yeah. I think the only other instance where you found yourself in instances where a woman was the killer was in the evening American television dramas. Perry Mason, for example, frequently had, you know, it would turn up that a woman was the killer, but it was never...
That would usually be part of the twist, because yeah. They wouldn't suspect a woman of being the killer. And
so, following that line of thought, do you think these movies, the first one is specific since Siskel and Ebert called it out specifically, do you think it was misogynistic? Do you think that, oh my God, it's just women in danger lying on the ground screaming and cowering in terror?
For me, for it to be truly misogynistic, there really has to be a clear, you know, degrading and hatred of women. And I never got that impression because some of the most brutal kills in this movie were done to men.
And even if you look at just the totals, men outnumber the women in this one instance.
I always will go back to the one of the iconic, second most iconic kill in the entire movie, the death of Jack.
You know, Kevin, arrow through the neck.
Arrow through the neck. And I mean, it's one of the most brutal moments in the movie. And right before that, we know that the practical Joker is slashed to death above him in the bunk, and he just doesn't realize it. And that one lingers, you know, it's one of the few deaths in the movie that lingers. I mean, Annie, when she dies, it's a quick slash of the throat
and you're done
You move on from her. To me, for it to have been truly misogynistic, The girl who dies on the archery range, I don't even think we actually see her death on screen. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I would say that is a argument that lands falsely in this case, and I think they're just applying expectations from other horror. And part of, I think they were, the Siskel and Ebert review was, they were shocked by, for what was, especially for American film, was a level of gore that had not previously been seen.
They also might have been coming away with a misreading of the misogyny in the movie because of the focus on the final girl traditionally in this genre, where you get 20 minutes of one character being menaced by the killer. In this case, you know, it's Pamela chasing her forever and ever and ever. So it kind of heightens the, oh my God, you're a woman and you're in danger, I think.
But it also shows the one of the interesting differences in the first movie that you don't see later in the series. Later in the series, once you go, oh my God, it's Jason, you know, you're still screwed. It's Jason. He's an unstoppable force. Most of the kills in this movie succeed through stealth. You know, Pamela is able to take most people out because they're not ready for the fact that, hi, what are you, oh, I'm stabbed.
Well, it's back to the Pamela is a smaller woman. She's not a big, beefy Hulk like Jason is. So you kind of have to rely upon the sneak attacks.
But with Alice, at least, I mean, they do fight. Pamela generally has the upper hand physically. She's stronger than Alice. But Alice isn't completely helpless in scuffles. Although her best chance is almost entirely throughout that sequence is struggle long enough to get away and then rely on the fact that she's actually faster.
Can I point out the one thing that bugged me about the final chase?
Technically, it's your show, so sure.
I hated every time Alice gets the upper hand and, like, knocks Mrs. Voorhees out and she's lying there knocked out and she runs away. And then she gets knocked out and she runs away. And then she gets knocked out and runs away. It's like, just fucking do something. Please stop running away. That got a little repetitive.
You guys are familiar with the movie Blackula?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah.
So one of the iconic shots in Blackula is the slow motion charge of the female vampire down the hallway, which they had to beg, borrow, and steal to get this high-speed camera to shoot that. But it is considered an iconic and one of the best filmed slow motion horror sequences, highlighting the tension of, oh crap, this scary thing is coming at me, and doing done in slow motion to heighten the tension. And I felt that they were going a little bit that once Alice picks up the machete and suddenly she's in slow motion, it tells you, all right, something different is happening now. We're at $6 million man speed now. Maybe you should pay attention to what's about to happen. Heightening the tension of, okay, now she has taken a shift. She's no longer playing defense.
That might be exactly why they did that repetition so much that they did. So when they finally did have her get her backbone to fight off her attacker,
it was significant.
It was cathartic.
And the fact that it ends with the most iconic kill of the reason that the film got so much controversy, let's be honest, that one shot is a good 75% of why most people were like, ah!
It's well done. It's shocking. It comes when you need your cathartic release at the most. Mm-hmm. So I can totally see it for being the demon.
Yeah.
So let's talk then, since this is a slasher movie, and choose your favorite death, please.
I have to say it's probably Kevin Bacon's, and the reason why is because I saw evidence of that first in a magazine before I ever saw the movie, and it's this picture of Kevin Bacon smiling with an arrow sticking out of his throat, like, ha ha, I've been killed.
It's such a well-done death, too. It's so visceral and disgusting, and holy Christ!
So I'm going to cheat. Usually Tony cheats on this show, but I'm going to cheat. Jason coming up on the back of the canoe.
You cunt! I wanted that one for my death! Ah!
Well, you know what? You let me go first.
Please, go right ahead.
But okay, so I know from reading, that was an idea from Tom Savini, who said, hey, you know what was recently really effective? Did you see the end of Carrie? And it's the, you know, you've had the catharsis of killing Pamela. You have Alice out on the boat in kind of idyllic bright daylight. The cops are there. Oh, she's safe. Great. And then, so everyone has completely relaxed. And then you have, out of nowhere, this movie that's been pretty grounded, suddenly a clearly supernatural event happening. The decayed corpse of Jason coming out of the water to attack Alice and pull her under. It's one, you know, it's the, everyone focuses on that decapitation as what drove people nuts. But I think more people were scared of Jason coming out from under the water.
That technically isn't a kill.
Yeah, you're right, but yeah, I mean, you're right. I'm cheating.
Yeah.
But it's
the thing, Tony wanted to cheat too. So.
But it's the thing is, when we're talking kills in a movie like this, the kill is the scare.
Yeah, very true.
And so for this movie, that is probably the best scare in the entire film. I mean, otherwise I'd be going straight for Pamela's death because it was, again, the heroic moment of the movie and just a damn fine special effect.
Mm. Tell you what, as the showrunner, I will allow it.
Thank you.
I am going to go with Annie's death, which isn't necessarily that scary or visceral or anything, but just such a well-done effect. I mean, you see her pulling her head back and you see the latex separating on the slit of her throat.
The makeup work by Tom Savini, who is, you know, this is where he showed the world, hi, I'm on the same tier of Rick Baker, take me seriously, and thus did it happen, and he has gone on to be, you know, some great film work. in front of and behind the camera.
The one thing we need to throw a bone to before we wrap this up is Henry Manfredini and the music is fucking tight.
Yes.
There's a reason why that score is iconic. Why that sound, you know, it is immediately sets people in a mode of, okay, something spooky's happening. The fact that it uses voice so heavily.
It's nice. It's simplistic. It's not very listenable. If you took like the album and just like put it on the turntable, it's not that great. But if you, in the context of the movie, it is so iconic and perfect.
I mean, it's not like John Carpenter's music, but for what he's trying for eliciting mood, fantastic.
All right. Well, that's Friday the 13th, and we could just go on forever and ever. So we're just going to stop.
This is usually where you ask us, is it nasty?
Yeah, and yes, it is. So was Friday the 13th, the first one, nasty?
Here's the thing. If we're talking about gore, for the era this came out, you know, absolutely the gore was, because the special effects, this is Tom Savini. This is a master of the craft who, this is sort of where he created his bona fides. And there's a reason why the death of Pamela Voorhees is iconic.
Even though you can still see the toothpick sticking up that we're holding our head on.
You know, because you're not noticing, because the rest of it is going, the blah, blah, blah. I remember when the movie came out as a teenager, and my local newspaper just ripping it to shreds, but it was because the reviewer was so shocked by that specific scene.
If you watch that scene 100 times like we've all done, you can start to pick apart the flaws in it. You can see the toothpicks. You can see the hands clasping. They look like dude hands with hair on them. So once you pull up the curtain back, you can start to see the magic fall apart. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you watch it with the eyes from 1980, the first time seeing this, I could see that totally being shocking.
I saw behind the scenes production stills before I saw the movie. And one of the ones that I saw, it could have been in Fangoria. More than likely it was. Mm-hmm. But it's a shot. It's Kevin Bacon. And it's obvious he's in the mid. He's got a big open mouth grin. He's obviously like laughing. And it's and there's this arrow sticking out of his throat. And he's like, ha 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 ha. And I'm just like.
Yeah. And what really sells that scene, that because the effect went wrong, they basically the dude was underneath the bed and like had this tube that he was blowing the blood up, and it got stuck and like started bubbling like with air, and so you see the more blood coming out and bubbles coming out, and it really is like, holy crap, that looks good, all because the effect went wrong.
Yeah, happy accident. But so when we're talking about is it nasty, the fact that for the censors looking at this, it was an at the time unprecedented amount of gore. I'm going to give more slack to Is It Nasty and the people making this list than I normally do, because I understand why it shocked them.
I'm going to say yes for one sole reason, and that's because I've been consistent all project long, because of the snake killing. Because there's an actual real-life snake, actually real-life being killed. And it was Tom Savini's idea. It's like it was like drawing upon an event that happened to him at summer camp many years ago. And so they said, okay, we're just going to shoot the scene. Whacked off a real snake's head. No, on the list it'd go.
In a modern era, yeah, that right there would have caused an uproar in a modern audience if the film were made today.
Yeah. But if you took that off the table and just the rest of the movie, no, hell no. But that one scene puts it for me.
All right. So I think we all agree to one degree or another. This is the one where we go, okay, we'll give you this one.
So usually this is the point of the show where we ask, did you like Friday the 13th? However, it's Friday the 13th. Nothing we say is going to influence your opinion, and it's Friday the 13th. We fucking love it, I assume.
The thing I was thinking about with this, I mean, obviously, yes, but it comes back to what what I'd said earlier about the giallo. And that is, especially looking at the first film, it's a very well-made film.
So the question then I have for you, gentlemen, is where does Friday 1 fit into your favorites?
I mean, it certainly goes above Goes to Hell. Almost everything goes above Go to Hell. You know, because here's the thing. I actually have a fondness for New Beginning.
It's not as bad as everybody piles upon it.
Yeah, and I think part of it is I appreciate what they were trying to do.
That is one of those movies where if you look at it without the baggage, if you take the Friday the 13th lenses off and just say, okay, slasher movie, hit me with what you've got.
Yeah.
It's not that bad.
I'm with you. My favorite is probably New Beginning, though. So I think number one, if I really were wanting to slot it into where I felt with the series, I think it would be like fourth place. I'd put it below New Beginning. I guess I really also liked three. So, you know, it'd be like New Beginning, 3D. And honestly, I think one of my other favorites in that series is New Blood. And then I would put number one. Because I'll be honest, I do like number one more than I like number two.
So where would you put number one in the franchise?
Well, you've heard me over the years say repeatedly, Friday the 13th, part three, that's the one I like the most. It's all because a guy gets his head squished and his eye pops out. That was the selling point that made that my favorite film. But after that, it comes around to a number of the films that you guys really, really like out of the series are films that I haven't actually been able to sit through. And it's not because I was squeamish.
Yeah.
It's because I'm bored. Yeah. They were boring to me. But apples, oranges, if you want to look at it from that point of view. But no, typically I really like the third film best of all. After that, I like Jason X or Jason 10. Cyborg Jason flying through space on fire. You cannot beat that.
So there we go. It's Friday the 13th. Ta-da! Alrighty, well, thank you for joining us as we tear apart Friday the 13th like a demented psycho killer. Next week, we're going to be watching part two. So be sure to come back and check out what we have to say about that one. In the meantime, drop us an email at thevideonastyproject@gmail.com. Tell us all about Friday the 13th and the first time you saw it and how much you love the film and blah, blah, blah. And until next week, stay evil.
You know what I mean? Would you just get off a spaceship or something? Colombian gold, man. Grass, hash, the weed, dig it?
Hey, what's he talking about?